Splendid. Thank you very much. It was a very nice introduction and entirely accurate, unlike most introductions that I've had. hello, everyone. Nice to be here. So this talk is ostensibly, at least, about social networks. So the first question I have to ask is, what am I, a physicist, doing giving this talk about social networks? And more saliently, what are you, a bunch of physicists, doing listening to it? And you may be asking yourselves the same question. However, there has in fact been quite a lot of interest within the physics community in social networks in the last few years. And there are a number of reasons for this. One is, well, social networks is a very old field. So it's been around for many years, like 50 or 60 years. And there's very good reasons for being interested in it. But physicists only really discovered it in the last 5 years or so. It turns out that actually there are a lot of techniques from statistical physics which are very useful. People have usefully applied scaling theories and renormalization group stuff, Monte Carlo methods, generating functions, a lot of stuff which will be very familiar to us from physics, to studying these network models, and gotten a lot of cool results. However, there is, as Jean mentioned, another reason why you should be interested in this talk today, which is because it's about you. The social network that I'll be talking about today is the network of collaborations between scientists. And so this is a great topic to talk about because there's nothing that we like so much to talk about as ourselves. So to begin at the beginning, a social network is, I don't like this light. Here, stop shining at me. A social network is a collection of people, or it can be groups of people, who are connected together in pairs by some kind of connection. So in the traditional jargon, the people or the groups of people are called actors, and the connections between them are called ties. In graph theoretical language, they're called vertices and edges. So I'll sort of use those concepts interchangeably. So the actors could be, they can be individual peoples, they can be groups of people like teams or companies or something like that. And then the ties between them can be, well, they can be anything you want. I mean, it depends on what problem it is that you're interested in. So people, for example, have studied school children. So they'll go into a school and they're interested in who's friends with whom. So then the tie is friendship. A is friends with B. If you were talking about companies, ties between companies might be something like business relationships. So ties can be defined in, you know, whatever way is appropriate to the particular thing you're thinking about. So why does anybody care about this? Why is this interesting? There are lots of reasons why social networks are interesting. There are some obvious ones which have probably occurred to you. For example, who knows whom is very important for the spread of information. How does a rumor spread? I start some rumor, I make up some totally fatuous comment, and I tell it to all my friends. And then they tell it to all their friends, and they tell it to all their friends. And very soon, you know, it's gotten everywhere in the world. And clearly, the structure of the network of who speaks to whom is crucial for understanding how a rumor would spread. Or it could be news, or it could be a joke. A more important example, perhaps, is the spread of disease. Now, if the ties between people are, you know, some physical contact that can spread a disease, like me coughing on you, then that particular network, the structure of that network is very important for how this disease is going to spread, and it's hopeless trying to do a simulation or some kind of modeling of an epidemic unless you know what the structure of the network of contacts between people is. So there are a lot of people who, you know, spending huge sums of money doing exactly that. There are, however, some more non-obvious kinds of reasons why you might be interested in social networks. In fact, if you speak to the social networks people, you know, go to a sociology department and speak to somebody who works on this for a living, then they will tell you that actually everything is to do with networks. It's the only thing that you have to worry about, and once you understand the network, you understand everything. This is probably an extreme point of view, but there's something to be said for it. Almost all the things that people look at in sociology these days are in some sense connected with the patterns of connection between people. So it's an important thing to worry about. It's something that I've been thinking about for a while. Most of the stuff that I've been doing has been on modeling. It's mostly been trying to construct various kinds of models of social networks. That's not exactly what I'll be talking about today, though I'm happy to talk about it a little if you want. So here's just a brief little bit of background about the sort of things people study in the past. Here's a few examples of social networks that I randomly pulled off the internet. This is sort of the typical thing you should think of, a bunch of dots connected together by lines representing the ties. This particular example is from a study of a bunch of politicians in an unnamed Midwestern state, and the lines between them are supposed to represent political affiliations between them, and people study this, and then they try and say something sensible about politics on the basis of these kinds of things. Here's another one. This is a very famous study, actually. This was a study they did back in the 60s of a bunch of women in an unnamed southern city, and the interactions between them here were common attendance of social events, parties, and things like that. And so they were interested in sort of how information and stuff moved through their community by looking at these things. Perhaps the most famous study of social network, you may well have heard of this one. It was conducted by Stanley Milgram in the late 60s. This experiment, it was really a rather cleverly conceived experiment. What he did was he took a bunch of letters that were addressed to a stockbroker friend of his who lived in Boston, Massachusetts. He was at Harvard at the time. And he sent these letters to a bunch of people who were chosen at random from a Nebraska telephone directory. Apparently, he considered Nebraska to be about as far as you can get away from Boston, Massachusetts, socially speaking, without falling off the end of the earth. And the instructions that went with the letter were that they were to get the letter back to its intended recipient, namely the stockbroker, but they could only pass a letter to somebody that they knew on a first-name basis. Okay. So you probably didn't know this stockbroker in Massachusetts, but maybe you know somebody else who lives in Massachusetts, or maybe you know somebody else in the stockbroking business, or whatever. So you just do whatever you think is best, and you try and get it closer, in some social sense, to this target person. And then he just counted up the number of steps that it took for these letters to get back to the target person. Some of them didn't arrive. But the ones that did arrive, he discovered, took an average of about 6 steps to get there. And this is the origin of this famous result about the 6 degrees of separation, how it only takes, you know, 6 steps to get from anywhere in the world to anybody else, which made into this play that you may have seen about 10 years ago, which also made into this movie starring one of the Men in Black there and Rizzo from Greece. And then, you know, that's in turn spawned a huge industry. You may have played this Kevin Bacon game. Do you know this one where you have to connect movie actors to Kevin Bacon via movies that they've acted in together? So, you know, like Clint Eastwood has been in Bridges of Madison County with Meryl Streep, and Meryl Streep was in A River Wild with Kevin Bacon. So there's 2 steps. It turns out that like almost all actors can be connected to Kevin Bacon in 2 or 3 steps. So it's a very small world in the sense of Milgram's experiment. It doesn't take many steps to get anywhere. And of course, it doesn't have to be Kevin Bacon. There's no reason. It's just sort of randomly chosen to be Kevin Bacon. It could be anybody else. Here's sort of the 6 degrees of Kate Blanchett, one of my favorite actresses. She's actually prettier than this. She's not looking a little sickly in that picture. And here's one that I got out of the New York Times one day. They did the 6 degrees of Rogers Hornsby. This is now the connection between 2 baseball players if they played on the same team together, and then see how many steps it takes to get to this guy. I actually know nothing about baseball whatsoever, so I'm no expert on this, but I gather this guy was a baseball player of some kind. Okay. Here's another one that I found in the newspaper, the 6 degrees of Monica. I shudder to think what the definition of a connection is in this particular one. I don't know how they define a tie. They don't actually say anywhere. There's all sorts of things. So here's Kevin Bacon, and here's Saddam Hussein, and O.J. Simpson, Rudolph Giuliani, and that's Eeyore down the bottom there. Okay, so you get the idea. You can have a lot of fun with this stuff. Oops. So you have a lot of fun with this stuff, but there is a sort of serious side to it, which is connected to, well, thank you. That's very nice. Which is connected to all this disease spread and spread of information and stuff like that. Don't worry about it. Well, yeah, it's already sort of blanked. Yeah, don't. It's fine. Yeah. Well, thank you. So, I had a postdoc, Duncan Watts, who came and worked with me about 3 years ago, I guess, now, who got me interested in this stuff. And we started off by doing a lot of this sort of modeling work, saying, well, how can we make models of these social networks to the sort of thing that you would use, for example, as a substrate for doing a simulation of epidemiology of some kind. And we had a lot of fun with that for a while, but after a while I sort of got frustrated with the quality of the data that are available. So how do you get the data for these social networks? And what you do basically is you go out into the field, they always call it the field, you go out into the field and you interview people. So, you know, you just usually try and find some community that's sort of closed, like a high school or a religious community or an island community or something where you can expect most of the ties between the actors to be within the community and not very many to be outside. And then you interview people and you just say, well, you know, so who are your friends then? And then you draw the network, or quite often you just send out questionnaires, you know, say list your five favorite people or something like that, and you draw up the network. And as I see it, there are a couple of very serious problems with this way of collecting data. First is that the number of data you get are very small. It's a very labor-intensive business. You know, if you're interviewing someone, it takes an hour or two to interview someone. If you're doing these questionnaires, then you still have to like collate all the questionnaires and copy down the responses, work out what the hell they wrote, type it all into the computer, make a network out of it. As a result, the typical studies run to, you know, tens of people. Well, you saw some of those networks that I put up there, which had like 15 vertices on or something like that. They're not big. There are some which run to hundreds of people, but 1,000 is extremely rare. So you may be talking on order of 100 data points among these networks, which is not very good for doing statistics with. You know, I want 1,000,000 data points, I don't want 100. The other problem is, obviously, it's extremely subjective. You know, you're just asking people, who are your friends? And what one person means by friends is completely different from what somebody else does. If you do these, there have been several of these studies of school children. You find some of these school children, they'll put down everybody in the entire school. Every single, they'll go to the trouble of writing the name of everybody in the entire school down, and then saying, those are all my friends. And somebody else will say, I only have two or three friends. These are the only people I talk to. And it's very clear that these two people are using very different definitions of what you mean by a friend. So there's big and essentially uncontrolled subjective errors in this thing. So I'm not the only person who has worried about that. A lot of people have. Actually, one of the things that people in physics working on this have been doing is looking at networks which are not really social networks in the strict sense. Just because the data are better from them. One example that people have looked at quite a lot is power grids. Here's a snapshot of the part of the Western power grid of the United States, and people have sort of studied this as a network, and you could sort of see it as kind of a social network. I mean, it's not a social network, but there's something about its structure which obviously reflects something about the structure of the society which built it. So it sort of has something to do with society. Here's another example. That's a transmission grid in Spain. Of course, here's one very famous example that people love, and they've been studying this to death recently. This is a skitter data for the internet that's essentially showing you roughly packet traffic between various collections of computers on the internet. And people love studying this stuff, and there's been a lot of recent papers about this. I haven't really been working on the internet. I think it's overdone. Maybe you saw this paper in Nature recently about the diameter of the World Wide Web. So this is not the internet now. This is the World Wide Web, which sort of sits on top of the internet, and it's a collection of papers, and you can view it as a network because they have links between them, and then you can ask questions about, you know, how many links, how many degrees of separation are there between one page and another? How many links do you have to click on before you get from one randomly chosen page to another, and so forth? And you know, those are reasonable questions to ask. And in some sense, this is a social network. You know, the World Wide Web, it's a bunch of pages. They're all about something, or they represent a person, or they represent a company, and there are connections between them. However, if what you're really interested in is actual social networks, who knows whom, then I think power grids and the internet and so forth are a bad proxy for the real thing. So I had to think about this, and I was thinking, well, what could you do that wouldn't be one of these interview-type studies, but would still be a real social network, actual people connected to other actual people, and would have, you know, a good supply of data, numerous data, accurate data. And I came up with a few possibilities, but the one that seemed most promising and the one that I ended up pursuing was this idea of scientific collaboration networks. So the idea here is that you get a bunch of scientists, that's us, and you draw lines between them in pairs if they've written papers together. Okay. Now this is something which the data exists for, right? Because we have very good computer databases of papers that have been written. And it's something for which you have an extremely precise definition of what you mean by a connection. Because if you have a paper with these two people's name on it, then there is definitely a line between them, no question. You know exactly 100% certainty that they wrote this paper together. So the data are both very reliable and extremely numerous. Hello? Did you have a question? So you could believe that this thing forms a social network of some kind. So it's a pretty good bet that if two people wrote a paper together, they know each other. It's not 100% true. There are exceptions to that, which I'll maybe come to a little later on. But it's a pretty good bet that they do. So it's a real social network of connections between actual real people. And you could believe that this shows, you know, the small world effect and all those kinds of things. Here's a little example to persuade you of that. This dot is me, okay? It doesn't look like me. Use your imagination. Okay, so that's me, and then here's all the people that I've written papers with in the last 10 years. About 30 of them. Okay, now here's all the people that they've written papers with in the last 10 years. There are 623 of them. So you can imagine that this network would show the small world effect, because you think the number of people that you're reaching as you go out by more and more steps is sort of growing exponentially. So how many steps of growing exponentially do you have to take before you've got everybody in the entire community? And obviously, that's a logarithmic number of steps. So the typical distance is going to be logarithmic in the number of people in the whole network. There's what? There are no names repeated along the edge, and collaborative ties between people in the same circle have been omitted in this figure. So there are lots of collaborations sort of going across the circle, but I didn't put them in because it made the figure incomprehensible. So here's what I did. I got hold of a number of databases, these big online databases of papers, and I actually constructed these networks. It's actually something of a job, politically speaking, to persuade people to give you an entire copy of their database. They're fairly protective about their data. So there were some things I wasn't able to get hold of, but I got hold of, you know, a decent cross-section of different sciences and so forth. And essentially all you need here is the author's names on the paper. That's another way that you can persuade people to give you the data. You don't need title, abstract, journal reference, any of the things that they actually sell, you don't need. All you need are the names of the authors. So they can just send you a big ASCII file, one line for each paper with the names of the authors appeared on that paper. And then you write a bunch of software which goes through these and does lots of text handling things and works out when the same person's name occurs two times and all those things that you have to do. It's actually a moderately complicated job, computationally speaking. Don't try this at home. These are big networks, had a big parallel computer, spent a week or two developing the software. It's a non-trivial task. So the databases that I analyzed were, the largest one is called Medline. Some of you may have heard of it. It's a big database of biomedical research papers, published papers, papers that have appeared in refereed journals. It's maintained professionally. They have a big staff of people who actually type in all the papers. That means there's very reliable coverage. If a paper appeared in Nature, it's in the database. Another one I looked at is the Los Alamos preprint archive, which is an archive of physics preprints self-submitted by their authors, which means that if you don't send your paper there, it isn't in the database. So that means his coverage is less good. It's kind of fun because it's about physics, and so it's full of names of people I know. Spires is a database of high-energy physics papers, which has very good coverage, goes back to about 1974, and is professionally maintained. So if the paper exists, it's probably in there. It also contains both preprints and published papers, which is nice, because there's no reason why one should discriminate against preprints in this particular context. Just because the paper is a preprint didn't make it into a refereed journal. It's every bit as good an indicator of a social connection between two people as a paper that did get past the referees and made into print. And then the other database I looked at was something called Ancestral, which is a database of preprints in computer science, which is kept at Cornell. So first, I will just run through a few sort of basic statistics so you can get an idea of what these databases look like. Here's some things. So the total number of papers, is there a pointer? No pointer. Anybody know? Oh, I see. Okay. For keeping people in line. All right. This'll do. Stout piece of bamboo. So total number of papers ranges from about 2 million in Medline to about 13,000. Those papers are all over a five-year period from 1995 to 1999. I looked at just a five-year window. There was a couple of reasons for that. One is, I really want to do a static snapshot of a network. There's interesting questions you could ask about how it evolves in time, but until I know what the static structure of the thing is, it's ridiculous to start looking at the dynamics. So there's a basic, first thing you want to look at is, what's the network like now? And of course, you can't ask what it's like at an instant, because you're talking about the publication of papers. So you have to choose some window. So you don't want to be too long, because it's got to represent the static snapshot, but you don't want to be too short. You want to be long enough that if two people have a regular collaboration, they're essentially guaranteed to publish a paper during that window. So I chose this five-year window from 95 to 99, and the other advantage of that was that all these databases cover that interval of time. Some of them don't go back very far, like the Los Alamos Archive only goes back 8 years, whereas Medline goes back to 1961. So I wanted it to be the same interval of time, so that allows me to actually make direct comparisons between different subjects. You can see in some of these numbers big differences between the ways that different scientific subjects behave. Total number of authors ranges from about 1.4 million down to about 12,000 in the computer science database. The number of authors is actually a little tricky to estimate, because it's possible, first of all, that two people may have the same name. And second of all, it's possible that the same person may identify them differently, identify themselves differently on different papers. You know, they give their initials differently or something like that. These are both things that you have to allow for. So what I did here was I did all the analyses twice. I did them once using first initial only. So no matter how you gave your name, I just take the first initial and the surname. Okay. So this is pretty much guaranteed. So always, if the person really is the same person, it will spot that they are the same person. But it's also going to, mistake many people who are different people for being the same person as well. The most common name in the database is S. Lee, and you wouldn't believe how many people are called S. Lee. So you have to allow for that. So the way that I did that was then I did a whole analysis again using the complete name as they give it in the database. So now if two people give their name differently, then they are assumed to be different people, and that means that, you know, J. Smith and J. A. Smith are now assumed to be different people, even if they were really the same person. So the first of those estimates tends to underestimate the number of authors in the database, and the first tends to overestimate it. So you get upper and lower bounds on the number of authors. So the true number of authors in the database lies somewhere between this number and this number here. And that allows you also to make estimates, upper and lower bounds, on many of the other numbers that I'm measuring. And most of these, when there are error estimates on these figures, those are how they're ascertained. So mean number of papers per author in a five-year period is about 4 or 5. People tend to publish about one paper a year on average. An interesting exception is here in high energy physics, 12 papers in a five-year period. Why would that be? Well, one guess is collaborations are very big in high energy physics. And you have more people around who want to write a paper. So if you have a collaboration of 1,000 people, then it's not that difficult to write 12 papers in 5 years. You have plenty of labor there available to do it. The same sort of thing is noticeable in the mean number of authors per paper. If you look at the number of authors per paper, it's sort of 3 or 2. In the purely theoretical things like high energy theory and computer science, it's about 2. In high energy physics total, including theory and experiment, is 9. So it's quite a lot bigger than other things. Even more noticeable in number of collaborators. This is how many people total, how many distinct human beings you collaborated with in a five-year period. It's 15 in Medline, You know, biomedicine, it's basically an experimental discipline. You have quite large groups. Same is true of astrophysics, 15 again, but some of these theoretical things, it's just down around 3 or 4. In high energy physics, it's 173. It's just a mean. Right, so, well, okay, I can show you some pictures of the distribution. I have those as well. The distributions are interesting. They tend to be long-tailed. They tend to look like a power law with an exponential cutoff. So you're right, the mean doesn't really tell, it's really telling you where the cutoff is. So it's an interesting question to ask why it takes that form. Why does it have this power law form of cutoff? The cutoff is almost certainly because of the 5-year window. Because it's just not possible for one person to write more than a certain number of papers in 5 years. So, you know, there's some fairly hard cutoff at the top end. Where the power law comes from is a matter of current debate. It's an interesting question. Okay, so now we sort of get on some graph theoretical things. The giant component, so people probably know about this, you know, if you do percolation on a random graph, you have this thing called a giant component, which is the equivalent of having a percolation transition, right? It's the point at which you get a bunch of occupied sites whose number scales as the size of the whole system. When you have only a single realization of a graph, as you do here, then you don't really know if there's a giant component of connected sites. You can't really say if it scales as anything at all. However, it's usually pretty clear that there is a giant component. If there's one component that fills sort of 1.2 million vertices out of 1.4 million, and then the next largest component is only 56 vertices, you have a pretty good bet that you're in the percolating regime of this graph. So what this is telling you is that in the Medline database, for example, there is one component of connected people that you can get from anybody to anybody else by going through a path of intermediate collaborators, and that component fills about 90% of the whole graph. 90% of the people in biomedicine are connected to each other. You can find some path from one of them to any other one. And then another 10% are not connected, usually just single papers that were written by a bunch of people who never wrote papers with other people. That's why these numbers down here are fairly small. These are the second largest components. And notice the giant component, it hovers pretty much around 70 or 80, 90% for all of these things. The only exception over here is the ancestral database on computer science. I think that the reason for that is just that database has a rather poor coverage. That database is maintained by submissions of technical reports from participating institutions. Means you sort of sign up as a university and say, we will send all our computer science technical reports to you. So very, very good coverage for those universities. You probably miss out many, many computer scientists because they're at some institution which doesn't participate in this. So the coverage of that one is not very good. It still percolates, though. It has a giant component there. Okay, so here's the Milgram thing. This is the number of degrees of separation. It's how many steps do I need to get from, on average, from one scientist to another scientist, and it's a small number. That's the crucial point really here, isn't it? It's 4, or it's 5, or it's 6. In physics here, there are 6 degrees of separation between any physicist and any other physicist if they're in the giant component. And the clustering coefficient I will mention later. Okay, so I am going to talk a little bit more detail about some of these things and sort of how you get them and so forth. So one of the most interesting things here to look at is these shortest paths. You want to know about paths between people. You can find the shortest path between somebody and somebody else in time of order n, where n is the number of vertices in the graph. So if you have 1 million vertices, that's doable on a good computer. It's no problem. Very simple algorithm for doing that. Breadth first search, which you're probably all familiar with, at least if you've done any computer programming. You start off with one of the people you're interested in, and you color them in, and then the algorithm is, you take all the people that you just colored in and you color in all their neighbors. So here, we colored in all their neighbors. And those are all the people at a distance 1 from the person you started with. And now you color in all their neighbors, except ones that have already been colored in. So there they are, all those guys along the bottom. And those are all the people at a distance 2. And you just go on doing this until the whole thing's been colored in and then you stop. So that tells you how far away everybody is on the network from this person that you started with. And you can do that in time order n, which means that you can do from everybody to everybody else in time order n squared, if you want to. So a very simple algorithm. It's like 5 lines in a computer program. So one of the first things you can do with this is you can calculate distances between pairs of people. So you can just sort of say, OK, I want to know how far this person is from this other person. I wonder what the path is between one person and another person. So here's an example of this that I did. So that's Duncan Watts at the top, the postdoc who's working with me on this, who's now at Columbia. And this is Laszlo Barabasi, who is another person who is another physicist who's been working in this field. And I deliberately chose them because they know each other well. They've met at many conferences. They've visited each other. They cite each other's paper. Interestingly enough, they're not very closely connected when you go through this network of collaborators. It's quite a long path, six steps here, which is above the average for this network. One, two, three, four, oh, five. Well, it's slightly below the average, but anyway, quite a long path. And what's more, it doesn't even stay within the subject of these people studying these networks. They just go, so here's Kim Sneppen, who's somebody I know because I did some mathematical biology stuff with him. So he goes sort of right outside the subject and then comes back in again. Now, one could imagine that a program that can find these connections between pairs of scientists would actually be, you know, actually have some practical use. Use broadly defined. So you could use this for telling people sort of what their connection is with somebody. You can imagine somebody wants to get in touch with somebody and they'd like what you call a referral chain, which is sort of the connection of links between you and them. So they sort of know, you know, if there's somebody that they could call up that they know and say, can you arrange an introduction for me to this person? Or they could just, you know, call the person themselves and say, oh, we have a friend in common, so-and-so, and maybe that's sort of a way of getting it in there. I think that, you know, with a chain that's five links long, maybe a little bit dubious, but you know, there's maybe some possibility that could be a useful thing. There's a project that Bart Selman at Cornell worked on called Referral Web, which was doing exactly this. It was trying to find chains between people. He worked for AT&T at the time. AT&T is a very big company with very many employees. And it's quite possible that, you know, that there's two people on their staff who have complementary interests that they could usefully work together, but it's very unlikely that they would know each other because it's such a big organization. So they put together this program that was supposed to help AT&T employees get in contact with each other in their line of duty by finding these referral chains between them. So people are kind of interested in this kind of thing. It's also just something which is fun to play with. So I brought along my program which does this. I thought it might be entertaining. So go. So this is a program where you can type in the names of, this is running on the physicists database, and you can type in the names of physicists, and it will tell you what the shortest path is between the two people you type in. Okay, so I thought we'd have some fun with this. And would people like to suggest the names of their favorite physicists, and we'll find shortest paths between them. Do I have a volunteer? Come on. Okay, well, I'll start off. I'm going to type in me. Okay, there's me. I'm number one. So we'll choose somebody else now. Matthew. MPH, right, there we go. Now it sort of hums away for a while, and it will say, you know, what is the shortest path between me and Matthew? And, you know, what I'm hoping to demonstrate here is that it's actually quite short. It's always quite short. It's never longer than about five or six or something like that. It unfortunately takes a little while because this is my laptop, which has been around for many years. It's slow as a dog. Okay, so, well, there's a fairly short path here between various people we know. Okay, so, me, Chris Henley, Yanné Condeff, Brad Marston. That was pretty good. And then there's another one there. It's not very good layout, this program. You know, obviously it could have done one like that and one like that. Instead it's got them across the middle. You know, there's a whole art, actually, to laying out graphs, which I have no interest in getting into. So this program just does it in steam-driven methods. Okay, come on, somebody else, just. Who? How do I spell it? I think I have to tell this one to go away. Come on, go away. Mm-hmm. Well, gosh, how long did... Eight. Okay, who else? Anyone else want to volunteer?
Jim Lange.
Jim Lange, all right. Five. La 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 la. Got to buy a new laptop next year. Sometimes you get these huge networks because there are an enormous number of different possibilities. This one seems to be very linear. Okay. Well, wow. So here are both at the same institution, and it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 degrees of separation. That's quite impressive. Of course, you have to remember there are some restrictions here. First of all, remember this is only the last 5 years, so if you go back more than 5 years, you may find a shorter path. Okay, so that's just a piece of fun. You have a lot of fun with these kinds of things. That's an excellent question. It's unfortunately something that's quite difficult to pick out. Question was...
Like here, you have this giant component, but geometrically, the best way to view this is not a 2 billion by 50,000 cube. But, this isn't what the geometry of the space is, but it's what this giant component actually consists of a lot of smaller, big components connected.
Right.
So there are fields. Yeah.
Right. So that
everybody, if you want to go from, and that's
not like first
So that's an excellent question and something that people are definitely very interested in. So it's this question of sort of, can you take the structure of the network and pick out communities from it? Can you just using the network sort of work out?
So far you've described very crude geometry. You just described mean distance.
Yeah. Exactly.
And that could be achieved a lot
of Absolutely, it certainly could. So the thing you described, so there are many ways that you could address that problem, some of which I'll go into. The thing you describe is not something that I've looked at, but people certainly are interested in that. There are ways of doing that, but essentially the problem is still open. There are ways that people are playing with. John Kleinberg, whose paper in Nature you may have seen a couple of weeks back, is one of the people who's interested in this and doing some very nice work in the area, and the various other people, but the techniques are not well developed. It's not really known. It's something people have been interested in for a long time, actually, because they were interested in it in the context of citation networks. So papers cite other papers, and that forms a network. And they were interested in saying, well, can you find sort of closely clumped sets of papers that all cite each other? And that would be a subject area, that would be an area of interest, and they're only loosely connected to all the other papers. And this is interesting from, you know, a library science point of view or something. You can actually work out what subject areas are of interest without having to go and ask people. You're not relying on somebody's impression. You can actually look at the data. And so people have been looking at that question for a long time, but mathematically it's actually a difficult problem. It's not a trivial thing to do at all, and so it's not really known yet what the best solution is to that problem. I think it's a very interesting problem. So I will turn this off again. Bye-bye. Okay, so here's sort of a quick example of one of the other things. Sometimes you get these very big graphs, because there can be many competing shortest paths, so sometimes you get something which is, you know, kind of huge like this. No, not exactly. And they're certainly extremely high dimensional. I mean, you know, if it was a random graph, then obviously infinite dimension and limit of infinite system size. There are people who would like to do sort of what you're hinting at, find out what are the you know, do the equivalent of principal components analysis or something. Find out what the canonical directions are that you should lay this thing out in order to embed it in some finite dimensional space. I think that's another very interesting question. It's unfortunately one where people have gotten nowhere at all. That graph embedding question is a well-known, extremely hard problem. A good question, but unfortunately not one that I can answer. Well, actually, there is one thing which I'll maybe come to a little later on, which sort of attempts to answer that question in a different way. I'll maybe talk about that at the end. Here's something slightly more sophisticated that you can do. You can also ask how many paths there are between people and who those paths run through. Here's a simple little algorithm that calculates how many paths from everybody to a certain person run through each vertex in the graph. Now, I'll explain why this is interesting in paths. This is actually something that people have been interested in for a long time, but they had really crappy algorithms for doing it that took time, order, and queued, where n is the number of vertices in networks. So you couldn't do it for big networks. So this is something that I came up with recently, and I'm just in the process of publishing at the moment, which is a new algorithm, very simple algorithm once you see it, for doing this, does it in time order n squared. You start off with your network, and you do this breadth first search thing like you did before, so you know how far everybody is away. And then you go through the vertices in inverse order of how far they're away, starting with the ones that are furthest, going back to the one that you started with up at the top there. And you give everybody one path. That's the path that starts at them. Obviously, it goes through them if it starts at them. And then the algorithm is you go through them in inverse order of how far they are away, and you take each one and you add its number to its sort of predecessor node, the one that it came from in the breadth first search. And if you have two predecessors, if there are two equally long paths there, then you take this one, you split it in half and add half there and half there. So you do that with all these ones that are distance two away, and then you do it with these ones that are distance one away and add them together, and you get 11 at the top, which is the total number of nodes in the network. And then the number that you get in each vertex is now the number of paths from anyone else on the network to this person at the top that goes through that particular vertex. Is that clear? So one thing that you can do with that is you can ask, so I'm connected to everybody else in the world, but how much of my connection to everybody else in the world goes through particular collaborators that I've worked with? It could be that your connection to everyone else in the world pretty much all goes sort of evenly through all of your collaborators. It could be that you've worked with one or two people who are really well connected, and they're giving you most of your connection to the rest of the world. And actually, it's the latter that you find. Almost always you find that your connection goes mostly through just one or two people, and everybody else doesn't really matter. And just to give a couple of anecdotal examples of that, here's David Campbell, friend from over at Los Alamos, who I picked solely because he had a large number of collaborators. And so in this, the giant component of this physics database is about 44,000 people. And out of those 44,000, paths from 22,000 of them go through his top two collaborators. So about half of them go through his top two collaborators, and the other half go through everyone else. And if you take the next two, you get about 75% of them. So you don't have to take very many of the people at the top in order to get most of the paths. And if you do a rank frequency plot of these numbers against their rank, you see something which falls off extremely fast. It sort of looks kind of exponential. So that indicates that. But it's only the people at the very top that matter. Here's another example. It's one of my regular collaborators, Gerard Barkimer. And again, out of the 44,000, now 12,000 go through this top guy, G. Delfino. I don't know who that is, actually. And then if you take the next two, me and Gunter Schutz, then you get about 50% of all of them. And if you take the next three or four, you get something like 75%. So this is a common pattern. I mean, I'm only giving you a couple of examples there, but something you see a lot. Now, you can take that one step further, and you can ask, okay, so I have all the people in the network, every pair of people, and they have a shortest path between them, or maybe several shortest paths, and I can ask how many of those shortest paths pass through each of the people on the network. So this is doing the algorithm that I described before, but doing it n times, one for everybody on the network, and then just adding up all the results. So it's asking, is there somebody out there who has a lot of the shortest paths between other people going through them? So this is somebody who may not be, you know, really close to everybody else in the network, but they're a sort of pivotal character because the information flow in the network is all going through them, and they're the sort of person that if you remove them from the network, it would do a lot of damage to the flow of information in the network. So these are sort of pivotally important people. So for the physics graph, for example, here's top 20. Alan MacDonald, interesting, is a top person, but there's some other people here that you probably recognize. There's Alan Bishop, and no surprise he's up there. He's Gene Stanley. Oh, look, who's this? There's Giorgio Parisi and various famous people. And then there's also some other people who you probably ignore. Like there's an awful lot of people in Dataplace called X Wang, and that's probably not one person. That's probably not one person. So they're sort of artificially high because it's not really the same person all the time. Okay, so this is sort of some measure of who's well connected in this network, but it's not actually telling you what most people would mean by well connected. What most people would mean by well connected is who's really close to everybody else. If I calculate the distance from me to everybody else and then take an average over them all, who's the one who's got the smallest average? That's the person who doesn't have to go very far for information, the person who has a lot of influence in the sense that they can talk directly to most people. So you can do that calculation with this network, and if you do, it turns out it gives you absolute garbage. For a reason that I'll explain in a moment. First of all, I want to give you an example of a case in which it does roughly appear to work, show you there is some sense in doing this. So this is the case, this is not a scientific collaboration network, this is the collaboration network of movie actors that I mentioned very briefly early on. This is the Kevin Bacon thing, okay? Two movie actors are connected if they acted in the same movie together. Okay? There's this thing called the Internet Movie Database, you may have seen it on the web, it's something where a website, you go type in the name of your favorite actor or your favorite movie, and tells you everything about that actor or movie, all the movies they've been in, all the people who are in that film, whatever. It also has an FTP site where you can go and you can download a big ASCII file which has all the names of all the actors that appear in the database, about 500,000 of them, and all the movies that each one has appeared in. So I just went and got this whole thing, and then I wrote one of these little programs which just like scans this file and works out what the network is from this list of actors. And I actually make up the whole network and then ran it through my programs and work out who are the most connected actors. Who's the person who's shortest average distance to everybody else? Not Kevin Bacon. Kevin Bacon doesn't even come close. Here's the top 10, sort of interesting. So number one most connected person is Christopher Lee. Does anybody actually know who Christopher Lee is? No? Well, I didn't either, so I don't blame you. It turns out Christopher Lee is a horror movie actor. And the reason he's very well connected is because these horror movies are made on fairly low budgets, and you can make a lot of them in quite a short time. You know, these are things which are shot in 2 weeks flat, something like that. So if you're a regular actor in horror movies, you can make a lot of horror movies. And the reason he's high up there is simply because he's been in a load of movies, very many of them. Number two most connected actor is Donald Pleasance. He's also been in a lot of horror movies. Number four, Vernon Dobchev? Who the hell is Vernon Dobchev? Steve Strogatz, who's one of my collaborators on some of this stuff, he's good friends with Alan Alda, who's sort of minor movie actor who's been in a few movies, and so he fired off an email to Alan and says, Alan, who's Vernon Dobchev? So Alan Alda deadpans back by email and says, you're my dry cleaner. Which was his way of saying he didn't know who Vernon Dobchev was either. So then we had to go and look him up in the Internet Movie Database, and it turns out that he's like character actor. He's somebody who does like 5-minute walk-on parts in movies and says a few lines, and then he goes off again. He's been doing this since 1960, and he's been in loads of movies, lots of them. See, it doesn't matter. You don't have to be famous to be in a lot of movies. You can be anybody. You get as many points for being in the movie if you're doing a bit part as if you're Julia Roberts. So maybe these people are a little bit difficult to explain until you think about it. These people down at the bottom, and then the next six are famous people, right? We've heard of Charlton Heston, Rod Steiger, John Gielgud, Michael York. These are famous people. So remember that this is a database with 500,000 people in it, and 499,000 of those you have never heard of. And the top 1,000 of them maybe you have. So this measure is clearly doing something right. I have no idea. That's a good question. I have the data, I can go and look, but I don't know the answer. Well, you're at the bottom end of a distribution, and it doesn't go up very high. Remember that the maximum distance in this network, the minimum average number? Well, that depends on the size of the network. So if it were a purely random graph, if it were a Poisson random graph, for example, then the average number is going to be log n upon log z, where n is the number of vertices and z is the average number of co-stars that each movie star has. So you can work out what the thing should be. And this thing, this number is actually not far from that, not far from being what it would be on a random graph. It's a little bit higher, but not much. But it doesn't go up very high either, because you know this is a network where most people are two or three steps away from Kevin Bacon. So maybe it goes up to 6 or 7 or something. So you're talking about 500,000 numbers in the range from 2 to 6. So it's not that surprising that they're close together. You just have to cram a lot of numbers in a small range. So actually, that's a good question, because one of the things about this particular measure is that it's not very good at distinguishing the top people. You know, the top people are crammed close together. So rather small change in the structure of the network could flip these around and change who's top. Whereas that previous thing that I showed you really sort of separates them from the boys, because it's the people at the top are well separated from the next people. You sort of go down by a factor of 2 just in the top 10. So the people at the top really are at the top. So what happens if you do this with the scientific collaboration networks? Well, as I mentioned, it doesn't work very well. And the reason, depends on your point of view. You might say it worked very well. So one thing you notice are that all the people at the top are experimentalists. And maybe you say, well, this is the right thing. Maybe an experimentalist should be at the top. However, you also notice, for example, that the experimentalists are top of the high energy theory database, which is ostensibly a theory database. It shouldn't have any experimentalists in it at all. Turns out it does have a small number of people who submitted their experimental papers there for no reason that's very easy to ascertain, and they come out top anyway. And so clearly, you know, this is not telling us quite what we want to know. And the reason is sort of obvious when you think about it. Well, the people who do experiment have much larger collaborations, and so they know more people. Over a 5-year period, they've collaborated with a larger number of people. And so just sheer number of collaborators that's helping them here. And this sort of leads you to think, well, maybe this is kind of unfair. Because, you know, it's very different if you're, you know, somebody who's collaborating on a paper with just one other person, and you spend all your time working on that paper talking to this one other person, then in social terms, you'll get to know them pretty well. Whereas if you're, you know, one peon on a high-energy experiment paper that had 1,500 authors, then it's quite likely that most of those people you don't even know at all. You probably never met them, never in the same room together. So one ought to allow for the number of authors on papers, sort of how well connected you are. Some should go sort of go down as the number of authors on papers goes up. The other thing that one ought to allow for is how many papers you wrote together. If you wrote 2 papers with one other person, then you should get twice as much credit as if you wrote 1 paper. You know, should know them about twice as well. So you can make a sort of primitive measure of the strength of connections between people by doing exactly this. So what this is imagine these are people, and they wrote various papers together, labeled 1, 2, 3 here, along with some other people. And so the way this primitive measure works is, so A wrote this paper 1 with B, and there were sort of 3 co-authors on this paper, along with A. So if you imagine sort of him dividing his time between his co-authors, he spent 1/3 of the time with each of them. So the connection between A and B gets 1/3 for that paper. And for this one where they just devoted all their time to each other, they get 1. And for this one where they had 1 other co-author, they get 1/2, and so forth. And then you just add them up so that they get credit for all the papers you did. So they end up with 11/6 as being sort of the strength of their collaboration on this. So you can do this with the whole network. And then you can do stuff like this. Here's a simple plot of me and my collaborators in the last 5 years. So that's me at the top there, and various other people. And the thickness of the lines is how much work I did with those people. It's supposed to be some measure of how well I know these people. So you can see that I done a lot of work with Gerard Buckman, and a lot of work with Chris Moore, and a lot of work with Duncan Watson, Kim Snappens, everybody else kind of lost in the noise. And then they don't all look like that. Some of them look more like this. This is an example of an experimentalist, or at least someone who's done some experiment. And this is a typical sort of experimental graph. It has a lot of thin lines because these are good big collaborations, where assuming people don't know each other so well because they spent less time together. So one thing I did, which was entirely uncontrolled experiment, was that I just printed out a bunch of these things for a couple dozen of my colleagues and just sent them to them, saying, oh, What do you think? Does this look right? So pretty much everybody thought that these things looked right, that they captured a lot of, if they had had to draw this graph, then this is how they would have drawn it as well. They made a few sort of obvious objections. Doesn't contain collaborators that I didn't collaborate with in the past 5 years. You know, I might have had a very close collaboration 10 years ago with somebody who doesn't appear on this graph. Also that it doesn't really reflect time I've spent talking to people who I didn't actually write a paper with. It's sort of obvious. Okay, our definition of knowing people is that you've written a paper together. Certainly true that you might spend a lot of time talking to the person in the office next to you and never write a paper with them. So those things definitely are present. But to the extent when people know how it's constructed, they say it's a pretty good reflection of the way things look. One thing you can do essentially all the things I just talked about, you know, this betweenness measure, you know, how many paths go through each person, or the funneling thing, how many paths go through each of your collaborators. Also, you can do all of those things with this kind of network as well, but now you weight it so that if you know somebody twice as well in this particular measure, then your distance to them is a half what it would have been otherwise. So just an example of that, here are the people who I claim are the most connected people in physics, according to this measure. So people who have the smallest average distance to everyone else in the network, according to this measure. So in various disciplines. And you'll notice here in condensed matter, what was this? Number one. And some other people you may know here, number two. Now, this is an interesting measure because this is really, it's not what you know, it's who you know. Kind of thing, right? Because how do you score well in this thing? Okay, you score well because you have close connections with other people. That's very important, you know. But also, those other people have to have close connections with the rest of the world. So it's not necessary, for example, to have a lot of collaborators. So here's somebody down in high energy theory who has 3 collaborators in this database, but nonetheless is number 5 out of 50,000 or something like that. Why is that? It's because they have tiny little distance to everybody they work with. You know, they wrote lots and lots and lots of papers with the same person, so their distance to that person is a tenth or a twentieth, some tiny little distance, and that person themselves is extremely well connected. You don't have to have a lot of connections. So you can either become well connected by having lots of collaborators who you all know moderately well, or by having a few that you know extremely well, which is, you know, the way it should be. This other column here is the number of papers that these people wrote. And all of these people wrote a lot of papers, pretty much. What this is telling you is that there's no substitute for writing a lot of papers. Writing a lot of papers will never do you any harm, because it doesn't matter whether you write them with all different people, in which case you then get sort of weak connections to lots of people, or whether you write lots of papers with the same people. Either way, you should be writing a lot of papers, that'll get you connected. Just another sort of cute thing you can look at is you can ask which are the thickest lines in the entire network. So here are the thickest lines in various subdepartments of physics. And there is maybe some that you could have guessed here by looking at. There's some pairs of people who it's not entirely surprising, have got very strong lines between them. I actually don't know who these two people here are, but my guess is they're probably married to each other. You call them. These two people? Here? Okay. Yeah, I didn't know that. These things are probably not a surprise. I mean, you could probably have said, if you just, you know, scan through PRL on a regular basis, who are the strong collaborations out there. But it's sort of fun to do. I guess I'm pretty much out of time, really. I was going to talk a little bit about the theory. So we've done a lot of theory on this as well. I mean, this is all just sort of fun data analysis kind of stuff. We've also done a lot of theory, have some nice models, some of which predict the behaviors of these networks extremely accurately. And I'd be happy to talk about those, but seeing as I'm out of time, maybe the best thing here is just to stop, and you're welcome to ask questions if you want to. And thanks very much for your attention. Everybody asked their questions during the talk.
How much bias is there in the results? How much does the results depend on which databases you happen to use. Let's say you take the same thing, you look at condensed matter theory, but you use Los Alamos, or you don't use that, you just use a Nature, or you just use Europhysics letter.
So I haven't done that, so I don't know the answer to that question. My guess would be things like who's in the top 10 will probably change around. Probably the same people would come high up as came high up, but you know, they would probably move around a little bit. For example, the Los Alamos database, you know, if you had to say who was the most connected person in physics, you know, you might choose, you know, some Nobel laureate or something like that. Just somebody that you know knows lots and lots of people. So, you know, I might say, so Phil Anderson, for example, is somebody I know. He won't be insulted by me saying this. So you might think that Phil Anderson would be really well connected. He's not, actually. He comes way down in the pecking order. And why is that? It's because it's a database that people send their own papers to. And Phil is over 70, and he doesn't use a computer. And the only reason any of his papers appear in the database is because they were sent in by his graduate students. But his graduate students are themselves people who are not well connected to the network, because they haven't written very many papers yet. So inevitably, he ends up not being well connected. And that's because of the nature of the database. It's something people send their own papers to. So if you had one that was like the Medline database, professionally maintained, you then might find that, for example, physicists who don't use computers were much better represented than ones who do in this kind of. So this current database is probably slanted, for example, towards younger members of the community who are happy using computers. So you would probably find that things would rearrange at the top, but I bet that you would find that sort of basic statistical measures do not change very much. And one of the interesting things about this study, which I didn't talk about very much, is the differences between different subjects. I touched on this a little bit, like the number of collaborators in high-energy physics and stuff like that. But there are some other more subtle differences that you can see. Particularly, I'm very interested to see the differences between the biomedical research and the physics research, because sociologically, those two communities are structured very differently. Biomedical research is like people in labs with a PI and a bunch of technicians and students and postdocs working underneath them. It has this very hierarchical structure. And whereas people in physics, it's more just kind of some random jumble. It's just whoever's working with whoever. And so there are a number of signatures that you see of that, quite strong signatures that you see in the data of the differences in structure between these different things. For example, one thing that you see, there's this thing which we call the clustering coefficient. It's also called transitivity. It's the probability, they're not quite the same thing, but it's the probability that two friends of yours will also be friends with each other. So go through all pairs of your friends and ask what fraction of them are friends with each other. So if 50% of them were, then you'd have a transitivity of 50%. So you find that in physics, it is about 50%. If you collaborated with two people, then there's a 50% chance that they also collaborated with each other, wrote a paper. In biomedicine, it's about 5%. So this is sort of an interesting thing. Why is this happening? So one sort of simple mathematical explanation is, well, you've basically got, what you're asking about is triangles in the network, and you've got this tree structure. People who, if it was just three authors on the same paper, then that still counts as a triangle. Yeah, but they may not have collaborated with each other. And they've all written papers with you, but not with each other. So you get very low clustering, because no pairs of your friends, your collaborators, actually work together. You know, two of your graduate students may be working on completely different projects. They know each other well, but they didn't publish a paper together. They only published with you. And so that may be the explanation. Right. That's one possible explanation. Another explanation that Deborah Feigenson suggested to me, actually, was that that many people get their names on biomedical papers because they made some apparently quite small contribution to it, like they synthesized the reagents or something like that. And then you put their name on their paper as the author. That's the way it's done. You know, in physics, that would be an acknowledgement. But in biomedicine, that's co-authorship on the paper. And then that person is kind of, you know, just because you collaborated in that rather restricted sense with that person doesn't mean that you're likely now to collaborate with somebody else that they collaborated with. If they synthesize reagents for somebody else, it doesn't mean you're likely to collaborate with them. So there may be some of that in there as well. So no, I haven't done any work on citations. There is a lot of work on citations. I kind of avoided it because it's been studied to death in the past. This has hardly been studied at all.
If you extend your database space back to 1905, you find that it was very well cited and not very well connected.
Very well cited and not very well connected. In what sense? Sorry.
Albert Einstein is cited and not connected.
Okay.
By the
well,
fact of your network, I thought he would be one of the most connected people.
Because he didn't collaborate with many people, he didn't co-author any papers. Well, that's certainly true. So, yeah, so there's been a lot of work on citations, and citations is really a different thing, because citations is not telling you about any personal contact between two people. It's what it's telling you is that two papers are on the same subject, and that may be an interesting thing. I mean, that's actually what more people have looked at, because they're interested in looking at subject areas rather than looking at people. I was actually interested in social networks, actually people knowing other people, which is why I want to look at co-authorship. So like I say, I kind of avoided citations, but there has been a lot of work on that. And there, you do get this long tail distribution. There are some people get cited an awful lot, things like that. But it's not really reflecting people knowing each other. So like you say, you could get cited a lot, but not be well connected. Yes. Certainly, that's true, and that happens to some extent. However, I don't think that that's the people who really get cited a lot are getting cited a lot through some, you know, it's this success breed success type thing. You get a lot of citations, then you get a lot more citations. It's some funny multiplicative process that's going on. And most of those are citations, like you say, from people that you don't know. So you can be very well cited, but actually not know very many people. And I think that that's a common thing. Yeah, actually, I hadn't thought of that, but that would be an interesting idea to sort of combine the co-authorship network and the citation network. Both of them be studied separately. Apart from this, I don't think anybody has done co-authorship networks before, so this is a reasonable first study, but that would be a nice way to go, to see if you combine that with these quite extensive studies that have been done on citation in the past, see if there is a connection between that. People are interested, you know, they use citations in doing things like, you know, tenure review and stuff like that. And they're interested in removing from the citations things which are sort of obviously non-citations, like I cited you, you cite me, and I cite my own papers, and things like that. And so you could use this some connection between the two to do that if you wanted to. I think the whole thing is essentially nefarious, and they shouldn't do it that way anyway. But if you wanted to, I guess you could do that. Anything else? So, no, I haven't. I think that there are a lot of interesting things that can be done. So this is one of the things that I've been toying with. I would like to look at the time development of the network and see what happens. I know of some examples of things where you can see stuff like that. You see events in the outside world happening in the data. I had one student who was working on citation distributions, and what he did was he got citation patterns for papers written by famous people, and he took papers that they wrote before they were famous. To try, and you can actually very clearly see when they become famous. You know, you get some Nobel laureate, you take a paper they wrote 5 years before they win the Nobel Prize, and he gets like one or two citations a year for 5 years. Then he wins the Nobel Prize, and he gets 300 a year for the next 5 years. So you can see very clear signatures, and it's quite possible that you could see similar things in this co-authorship data, and it's not something I've looked at, but it's something we're sort of toying with. It might be an interesting way to go. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that.
Is there any potential application to some better definition of conflict?
Huh.
Better?
Maybe. You know, I don't think we can use that person as a referee. They only seem to have an average distance of 3.5 to this person.
I was thinking the other way, that you get certain people who by adding one link double the size of their
number of people they're in conflict with. Well, sorry, where does conflict come into this?
You have written something with, you joined...
Conflict in the sense of they can't be asked to referee your grant proposal. Well, yes, I mean, certainly that's true. So you're right, you could use this sort of say who's too close to this person to be used as a referee, or say various other similar things. And certainly by adding one link or a couple of links, you can make a difference. Actually, Michael Lackman, who's postdoc at the Institute, I told him about some of this work, he wanted to know who was the furthest person from him on the network. So he was then going to call him up and say, hey, let's collaborate on a paper, and so reduce the size of his network very much. that was a very enterprising idea. And there have been some people who've suggested not exactly what you're suggesting, but something rather similar use for these networks, sort of evaluating people, you know, be like, well, Mr. Smith, we'd love to give you a job here, but I see that your connectedness index is only 5.7. I don't think we can really give a job at Cornell to somebody who's a connectedness index. So you can imagine do something. As I say, I think that would be a dreadful thing to do. I think that's terrible. But hey, you know, people can do with what they want. So one could maybe do what you're saying and use this as some way of defining distance to people. It might be a better way of doing it. I think the whole thing is kind of...
Yeah, you leave out many things. Everything is separate, co-publication.
Right, yeah, so exactly. Being in the next office, being at the same institution, you know, having being graduate students together, whatever. Right, absolutely. All of those things. Right, and people have talked about doing acknowledgements. It will be much harder. The nice thing about this is that you can study this million vertex network using a computer. It does all the work for you because you just have this big database. Acknowledgements would be a lot harder. But people have talked about that because, you know, there sort of ought to be credit for acknowledgements, and it is telling you something about the social network of people. If they say, I had useful conversations with this person, then you know they know that person. Oh, that has been done. Telephone company logs has been done. There's been some nice studies of telephone call graphs. You know, you get a week's worth of telephone calls from AT&T, and it's, you know, a billion calls or something, and then you look at the call graph. And I don't know how much it's really truly a social network, because it's dominated by business calls and by telemarketers, which are not real true social connections.
Telephone calls between your scientists.
I see. Well, yes, I think that might be an invasion of privacy. Okay. Well, I hope I haven't invaded anybody's privacy by doing this, just by borrowing their names.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.